live.
All right. Good evening, everyone. You're listening to the new WCEG Network on WCEGTalkRadio.com. Click live stream tab or watch us live on your smart TV, YouTube, WCEG Network. I'm Dr. Charles Ross, the host of Your Personal Finance, and I'll be with you for about an hour today. We're the Worldwide Community Empowerment Group, where we speak life into the community. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at WCEG Talk Radio and at WCEG Network. And of course, the disclaimer that the topics and opinions are those of the host, which is me, and not of the WCEG Network. Appreciate your support. So normally I would have a guest. This is our first inaugural. I did a show last December, but I thought I'd just give people a background of, you know, who is this guy talking about finance? And my background is I am the president of Rossville Holdings, LLC, which is a company. It's dedicated to principles of managing money. We invest in real estate, and of course, we have financial planning services. I'm the author of two books, Your Common Sense Guide to Personal Financial Planning, and the other one's entitled Your Common Sense Guide to Personal, God's Plans for Your Financial Success. I should know the name of my books, right? These books are available on Amazon, so feel free to get them. It'll explain some of my philosophy and what we're going to be sharing about. Also, I'm an educator. I call my educator job as my, I guess, side hustle, although I work full time. But before all this, I was a vice president for the investment department for a major bank. And if I call it, you know who it is. I had 30 years experience in financial planning and broadcasting. And I brought those two together to come up with a radio show called Your Personal Finance. And for some 20 odd years, that show was syndicated around the country. There were little vignettes that gave little tips on personal finance. Also, I was a personal finance columnist for Upscale Magazine and also for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution here in Atlanta, Georgia. Also, the host of a 12-part series on money from PBS called Money Maze. Also, did a video for Ebony and Jet Publishers called Money Power. And that's kind of what I've been doing for the last 40 years or so. I was born and raised in New York City and currently live in Atlanta, Georgia, and with my wife, Felicia, and I have four daughters. I'm a girl dad, as they say. So our topic for today is something that I was kind of struggling with this because I'm not a big person on resolutions and things like that. I am on goals, though. I'm always motivated by goals, things that you set out to do. But I think that the pandemic has changed that orientation. And so if we can think of financial resolutions or financial goals, things we're going to do this year, and I've got 10 of them I want to share with you today, okay, God willing. But one of the things I just want to caution you about is that it's been almost a year. In March, it'll be a year in the case of as an educator, where on March 13th of 2020, they shut down the school that I work with, and we went to virtual learning. And as of this date, we have not gone back into the building. We're supposed to go back on March 15th, but we'll see how that goes, because the metric they were using was basically 100 cases per 100,000. And now we're at 400 cases per 100,000. So it's just skyrocketing. I saw a report today that said that an epidemiologist said this pandemic, this COVID, is going to be with us forever. Like the flu or the cold, anything else, it's not going away. You just don't eliminate it. And if you've been following any of the reports, they've been indicating that, you know, it's morphing, it's changing. And, you know, one of the books I have up here is a book on genes and what you have to, you know, notice it ain't finance, but I just want to give you some insight, is that life finds a way. So even though we see this COVID as evil, in the scheme of life, it's just trying to survive. And it's morphing. And it's ingenious when you think about it for a second, that it's morphing, that you get a vaccine, it changes, you know, and I don't know all the details of that, but you have to admire that a animal, a microbe is changing what it is, so that the vaccine may not work on it. So anyway, I share all that to say that just be careful out there and make sure you're masked up and practice social distancing. So in saying all that, because of the pandemic, I think that we have to maybe kind of cut ourselves some slack, so to speak, you know, say, listen, you know, we've had to, survive in our pajamas or our house clothes for the past year. Some folks are really, you know, sequestering in place and not going out other than to get groceries and maybe gas. And that's it. And then other people, everything in between. But with that being said, there are somewhere about 40%, study said 40% of folks established financial resolutions. And so I think that's a good thing, you know, but if you're one of those people that, and of course the big ones that most people do is weight and usually finances, you know, so we're right in track. That's why you see all these ads or Weight Watchers and, you know, Lord knows all the other ones that they come up with to help you achieve your goals. And then of course, you know, I'm a member of a gym, and usually in January and February, you see it, they're jammed up. And the gym that I go to, they limit the number of people in, so it's not going to be crowded, but at the same time, people, January, February, by March, you've cleared out all the people who couldn't stick to their financial resolution. And I think they said somewhere it takes like 7 or 8 weeks to get a habit instilled in you. And I believe that, you know, wholeheartedly. I'm a biker. I have a bicycle that I ride. I just moved into my forever home with my wife and back in September, the last house we're going to buy before we retire. And now I have a park like literally 2 minutes from me. So I have no excuse to ride over there and ride my bike. And I've been doing that, you know, with the goal of trying to lose about, you know, 20 pounds. So, all right, let's dig in. Okay. So one of the first things that we want to talk about is, and I know you've heard it, you know, is setting a budget. And, you know, that is, you know, people talk about budgets, you know, almost like budgeting is a dirty word. But if you keep in context that a budget is a tool to help you achieve your financial goals, I think that you'll be more inclined to understand. And I think that really helps you focus. A budget is nothing but a tool to help you achieve your financial goals. And the bottom line on a budget, friends, the bottom line on a budget is that it's supposed to help you save money. Let that sink in for a second. If your budget is not helping you save money, then it's not any good to you. And you say, Charles, what do you mean? You're supposed to look at your budget at least once a month. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, you might have to look at it a little bit sooner than that. But let's say you look at your budget once a month. You have your budget, and then you have your actual. So you have what you said you was going to spend, and then what you actually spend. And then the hope is that every month you look at your budget and say, okay, I spent more money. You know, I budgeted $100 for eating out, and I spent $150. What happened? And then you could go back through the detail and look at that and say, okay, here's what messed up. I had some friends coming from out of town, and, you know, I went out to eat a little bit more. So it's supposed to help you make some decisions to help you spend less money than you're currently making, than currently doing. Okay, with that sink in, this will help you. So you look at every category and make sure that you know. And probably in the next couple of sessions, we'll maybe go a little bit deeper into budgeting to help people understand that. So if you're spending less than you bring it in, then the rest go in savings. And then one of your budget categories should be savings. So a budget is a tool to help you achieve your goals, but the bottom line is that it's supposed to help you save money. Now, I just said that you should look at your budget once a month. My suggestion is that you should look at your budget at least maybe And we'll talk about that in a little while, at least on a weekly basis. And there are so many tools. There's no excuse now for anybody to not be able to budget, because there's so many apps you can use on your phone, which I'm not a big fan of that, but if that helps you, then that's fine. There's so many apps that you can use on your computer. The one, you know, that I like is Quicken, you know, and it's easy to use. You can download, it's not very expensive. And also has a feature where you can have the your the things that you have on the Quicken on your computer, you can have on your phone. And so the great thing about that program is that you can download the transactions from your bank, and then you go through and, you know, categorize and put them to your budget. And if you do that, then looking at your budget, spending 5 or 10 minutes a week, maybe on the weekends or whenever you're off, to say, okay, how am I doing? Because if you wait to a month and you're spending more money in a category, you might be way over budget. But if that week you see that, hey, I spent more money in eating out, then I'll say, okay, next week I'm bringing my lunch or whatever, and make some adjustments. So spending 5 minutes to 10 minutes a week, I think you'll be in the top 20% of people that do that. If you recall, I used to, when I did this, because I've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for like 40 years, which right there sounds like a lot. But we used to talk to people about, you know, balancing their checkbook. And I don't think anybody balances their checkbook anymore, very few. Back then, about 30 years ago, maybe it was like 10%. I doubt they do it now. Now, with the different apps and programs you have now, you don't necessarily, you know, have to do that, because it'll balance it for yourself in your register. So I recommend to kind of end that whole diatribe there, is that you look at making sure that you have a budget, and there's no excuse. You've been sheltering in place for almost a year. There's no excuse now. I mean, if you don't come out, if you don't come out of this pandemic with a more education or a skill or a side hustle, it's not that you lack time, you lack discipline. And that's maybe something you got to get more of. Okay. I think I beat that up a little. So budget your money. All right. The second thing, you want to put more money away for retirement. Saving money on retirement is extremely important. Most people do it by their 401k or 403b or their IRA or something of that nature. They establish that. I encourage you to do that. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some avenues that you might want to consider, but here are some ways that you can save more for retirement. Here's some ways. Number one, save 1% more. Whatever you were saving last year, if it was 10%, bump it up to 1%. It's not going to hurt you that much. If you make $50,000 a year, and let's say you save 1% more and you get 6%, that's about $50,000, $60,000 in extra income that you're going to get. So I encourage you to bump up that up. You might get a raise. Excuse me. You might get a raise this year. A lot of companies, because of the pandemic and they're struggling, you might not get a raise. Excuse me, let me get some water here. You might not get a raise. But if you do get one, you might want to redirect it into your retirement fund. your tax refund that you get. You might want to, instead of saying, I'm going to go buy me a new car, I've been driving around because sometimes I have to go out a couple of days out of the week for work. And I see so many new car tags where, you know, they bought a car. So that stimulus money, a lot of people, I'm assuming, are using some of that stimulus money to buy a new car. And if that's what you need a car, then fine. But you should think about perhaps putting that money into your retirement plan. And that stimulus money that's coming, okay? Some of you have already got it. You might want to earmark that to your retirement, you know, fund. Any windfalls that you may get, you sell a car, some money comes out of anywhere, you hit the lottery, whatever, direct that money into your retirement fund. Make sure you're contributing enough to get your 401k max. Make sure you avoid penalties. Maybe you might want to, looking at your budget, you might want to eliminate an expense that you say, you know what? I've got these little expenses that come out. It could be subscriptions or something like that. And you say, you know, I'm not using that anymore. Let me get rid of that. It's only $10, $15 a month, but that's money that you can have in your pocket. Now, having I said about, you know, saving money for retirement, let's talk about the reality. Now, I've been doing this for 30, 40 years, and and it's very rare for me to meet somebody that has retired just on their 401k money. And if you do the analysis, you have to have started saving 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, for most people, they just haven't been able to do that. The money that you'd have to save to replace your income. And the theory is that whatever you're making now, you're going to need about 70, 80% of your current earnings to be able to retire. So depending on where you are, I would suggest that you look at real estate. And let me tell you why. Because real estate is one of the keys to building wealth. If you look at any millionaire, billionaire, they usually have two things in their portfolio: real estate and a business. And then thirdly, they may have some stocks or something like that, you know, thing like that. But mostly they have a real estate and a business. Think about that. The reason is that, as I said, they're not making any more land. People always need a place to live, okay? And as a real estate investor, let me tell you what my strategy is, and you take it for what it's worth. So I buy what we call sub 30 market properties. That means properties that sell for under $35,000. And then I rent them out for $500-$600 a month. Now let's do the math on that. I wrote all this down so you can understand it. So let's say a $30,000 property. I found a bank that will lend. Normally they ask for 20%. But they'll lend on 15%. In other words, on $30,000, all you have to do is put 15% down, which is $4,500, and then they'll lend you the rest. So on a $30,000 property, a mortgage be about $25,000, $26,000, you're looking at $250 a month as your payment. Okay, follow with me. And I wish I had a chalkboard or something, but let's follow me if you want, write this down. So I rent it out for $600. My mortgage is $250. The difference between those two is $350, right? So now you say, well, how much am I going to need for retirement? Well, let's give an example. Let's say you'll need $50,000, okay? So your net is $350. You can multiply that by 12. That's $4,200 a year in net income from that one rental property. So if you want $50,000 as retirement income, divide 50,000 by 4,200, that comes up to, you need 12 properties. If you have 12 properties, then you're going to net out $50,000 a year. Let that sink in for a minute. Oh, but it gets better. Why? There's something called Social Security. You know what the average Social Security payment is? It's about $1,400 a month. So let's multiply that by 12. I've done it for you. I'm gonna round it up. It's 16.8, but I'm gonna round it up to 17,000. So now you've got 50,000 coming from your rental properties and another 17,000 coming from Social Security when you retire. That's 67,000, almost $70,000. Sounds pretty good. Can you retire on $70,000 a year? If not, change the numbers. So you can double the number of houses to 24 or 20, whatever. My point is that you've got to find a way to get additional income. Now, I know a lot of people are still working. I'm 63 and I'm going to retire in about 3 years. They're working into the 70s and sometimes not because they want to, because they have to. Now, if you're in good health and you still want to work, that's fine. But I don't know many people who want to get up every morning at 6 o'clock and punch a clock if they don't have to. Okay. You look at life expectancy. The life expectancy, I think, is usually around 75, 80, somewhere around there. It's higher for women than it is men. But I can think of a lot of things that I can do, and I'm sure you can think of to do if you didn't have to go to work every day. If the money that you was coming in from your investments or Social Security or pension, whatever, then that's coming in that you can use that time to do something that you like to do. Take up photography, take dance classes, travel, go see your grandbabies, go see some friends you don't know, travel, live your life. So I share all that to say that you've got to look at the options you have and just putting money into a 401k. Now, here's the great thing. You say, I don't have $4,500 right now. But guess what? If you have a 401k, you could take money or borrow money from your 401k to invest in real estate. Yes, you can. Didn't think about that, did you? It gets better and better. And so once again, it's something you want to do. And like I said, I encourage you to get educated. There's some books that I would recommend. I don't deal with real estate much in my book, but there's a book called Bigger Pockets, I think, on real estate investing. You can find it on Amazon, and it'll give you some ideas. And, you know, I'm a real estate investor. If I'm a part of a network of real estate investors. And if you're interested, just text real estate. And I'm going to give you my email address, or to charlesross@outlook.com. charlesross@outlook.com. Real simple. Just send me, say real estate. I'll send you information on what we do in our network. Because one of the things about the network of real estate investors is that they're more than willing to share information. They're more than willing to share information. They just, because they know the pot is so big, they're not concerned about it. Now, let me just say, and I'll get off of this. You're saying $30,000, where am I going to find those? Well, let me just say, I can find them in Atlanta, where I live. And I don't invest in Atlanta. Well, I have one property in Atlanta, but I'm outside of Atlanta. Because in these small towns, you can find $30,000, $40,000 properties, okay? So let's keep it real. So whoever's listening to us, wherever you are, there's a couple of apps, Zillow, Realtor.com, Trulia. You could go in there, wherever you live, and search some zip codes and put in the parameters for $30,000 and see what comes up, okay? All right. I think I kind of hit that enough. Everybody understand that? You want to invest in real estate. That's very important so that you can be successful in your life and be able to be, you know, have the life that you want. Because I think it's just crazy that you spend, you know, 30 years, 40 years working and then live another 10 or 15 years. And then that's it, you know. So, all right. So the next thing, you want to improve your credit score, okay? Because, you know, back in the day, when you went to buy something, they looked at your income, how long you've been on your job, and all that stuff. Well, the credit bureaus and the companies that grant credit said, you know what, we just need a real simple system that we can just go to. Other things we're going to look at, but I want to see how this person has been managing their money and their credit score. Whether you like it or not, is an indication of how well you've been managing your money. Now, I realize stuff happens where your credit score may not be representative of where you are now, but your credit score changes literally every month around the first of the month, where all the credit bureaus, I'm sorry, where all the creditors share their information with the credit bureau, and your credit score can change literally every month. Now, there's a couple of things that you want to be able to do, make sure you do, to pay your bills on time. That is really goes a long way. Also making sure that you stay under 30% of your available balance. Okay. So make sure you pay your bills on time. Make sure that you stay under 30%. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, let's say if you have available credit of, let's say, 1,000, make it real simple. That means that you shouldn't have your balances over $300. I'll say that again. If you have a line of credit on a credit card and it's, you know, $1,000, then your balance shouldn't be more than $300. Now, I know that goes up and down, but as soon as it goes over that, you want to get it down because, and you know, it sounds counterintuitive because, you know, you want to think that the credit card companies want you to use your credit. But remember, if you go back in time and how credit cards were started, they were started for rich folks who didn't want to carry cash around. So they had this credit card that they could, you know, use it to charge things. And then they paid it off every month. Okay. That started with American Express. And then of course, now you have revolving like Visa and MasterCard and so forth. So remember, they were started that way. They weren't designed for folks, the middle class. They were designed for rich folks. So they didn't have to carry cash around. So you've got to use it for the purposes intended. So if you're using it, because I like using the credit cards, because especially if you're going traveling and stuff like that, you know, hotels and stuff, you know, a car rental companies, they'll say, okay, I'm gonna charge your bill is let's say $1,000, but we're gonna hold $1,300. You don't want to do that on a debit card. So credit cards are good. Plus, it's a natural grievance, because if something goes wrong with a product or service, you can dispute it through your credit card company, and you don't have to worry about tying up your bank account. So I like credit cards for that. But remember, keep those balances under 30% or less. And you'll be surprised when you pay off your credit cards. Guess what? You're going to get a lot of emails or things in the mail, you know, direct mail or whatever, trying to encourage you to get in another card or to increase, okay, your balances. And that's happened to me. They say, hey, guess what? You know, you're eligible to increase your available credit, your credit limit $1,000 more, because, you know, I've been very dutiful in paying it off. So that's something to think about. Also, you want to think about, we have a program with the financial planning services I provide, where your rent, if you're renting, to get credit for your renting. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Perhaps at the end of the program. Let me see any other notes I have here. So improving your credit, pay your bills on time, keep your available balance, your balances under 30% of available balances. And I think that's going to go a long way to improving your credit. Okay. The next thing, number four, pay your bills on time. Okay. It sounds like, you know, something that is, common, but sometimes people say, you know, there's nothing common sometimes about common sense. You know, so I encourage you to pay your bills on time. Come up with a system. You know, if you can, I would suggest that you put your credit card payments at least on automatic payment, your mortgage, other things that impact your credit, put those on automatic payment. Now, once you do that, you got to make sure you keep available balance for those things. I like to have bills so that they're paid on the 1st and the 15th or the 15th and the 30th. But if you can't do that, just make sure you keep enough money in your bank account so you can pay those bills, you know, on time through automatic draft. That way you don't have to worry about missing it. And don't worry about, oh, you know, do I have to pay my electric bill, my gas bill, my water bill, my car payment? Put those things on automatic pilot. I would suggest you do that. And, you know, to help you with that, I would say, you know, have two separate checking accounts. You know, one checking account is for all these automatic payments, so you always know they have money in there. And then another account where you use for your regular spending stuff. You know, when you have to, you know, buy gas, you know, go grocery shopping, you know, those kind of things. And then you keep a certain amount in your bill paying checking account, so to make sure that you'll always have enough to pay the bills that are coming up, you know, that's coming down the pike. Okay. You want to avoid those late payment fees too. That'll kill you, you know. And it used to be that, you know, they companies can't just charge anything. Every year there's a percentage that they can go up. I think the highest that they can charge right now is $28 or $29. And believe me, most of them do. They go right up to the limit to get those things, to get those late payment fees. And that can mess you up with your credit report as well. Okay. So the next thing, let's talk about making plans to help you achieve your financial goals. This is number five. So about halfway through here. I think when it comes to resolutions, you should have some financial goals that you're trying to achieve. And your financial goals should be in three different categories, three different areas: short-term goals, medium-term goals, and long-term goals. Now, short-term goals are going to be those that are between now and 1 year. So 1 year or less, things that you can do over the next year. It might be you're going to pay off a credit card that has $1,000 balance. You're going to do that by paying, you know, a little bit more down each month than the minimum payment. So that'd be a short-term goal. A medium-term goal, you know, that's going to be 1 to 5 years. Okay. So medium-term goals are 1 to 5 years. Short-term goals are 0 to 1 year. A medium-term goal might be Maybe you're trying to save, you know, money for a extravagant vacation. Maybe you want to go on a cruise, which of course cruises is not that popular now. So, but maybe you want to go to Tahiti, or you want to go to the Caribbean. My wife and I got back a couple of years ago from St. Martin, which is a real island where you can drive around the island in about an hour, not like Jamaica or Puerto Rico or Mexico, some of these other places. So you might want to have a medium-term goal in a year and a half, 2 years, you want to go to Africa, Middle East, wherever. And that requires you to save a little bit more. You need a long lead time to get that done. And then anything over 5 years would be long-term goals. And the obvious one would be retirement, okay? That would be retirement. And so that would be a long-term goal. All these goals have to have two things. Have to have a time frame and a dollar amount. In other words, how much money you want and when do you want it? If you don't have a time frame and a dollar amount, it's what I call wishful thinking. You just, oh, I like to go to Tahiti, but I don't know how much I need and I don't know when I want to go. So time frame, dollar amount. If you have those two things, then you have the tools to help you achieve your financial goals. That makes sense? Okay. All right. So short-term goals are those goals that are done in a year, 0 to 1 year. Medium-term goals, 1 year to 5 years. And long-term goals are those goals that you're going to achieve in, over five years. Typically, you're looking at, retirement goals. So that's something to think about. Let's see what else we got here. Got that. Creating an emergency fund. That's extremely important. Okay. Some people call it a rainy day fund. They're all kind of terms that you use it, but basically it's making sure that you have money, for emergencies, but also, if you lose your job or something of that nature, which is an emergency. And I would start off, if you've never had one, then I would say start off with 3 months expenses. So let's say, make it real simple. Let's say that you have $1,000 in monthly expenses, then you should be striving to set aside $3,000, okay? $3,000 in a bank account, and I'm gonna give you some criteria in a minute, that you can access pretty quickly. And, normally this is tied to your checking account, usually overdraft. So if something comes in that's, a little bit more than what you had in your checking account for whatever reason, that you can you'll pull from that. But the 3 months expenses are very, 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 very expensive. I would start there if you haven't done one. And I say that because, most people have expenses of more than $1,000. Okay. Not just salary I'm talking about your expenses. So that would be the first thing that I would look at. Typically, ideally, you want at least 6 months expenses. Exceptional is to have at least 1 year of expenses. So an example I gave you, $1,000 a month, that means you have $12,000 sitting aside. Now, here's the key, okay? Here's the key. That money can't be invested in anything that you can't quickly get access to. Let that sink into me, to you. In other words, that money has to be invested in a bank account where you can get access to it in an emergency. You can't put it in mutual funds. You can't put it in stocks and bonds. Okay. You have to have it accessible. Now, having said that, if you've gone out in the marketplace and looked at savings rates, I think what, 0.5%? If you're doing good, if you're getting 1%. But remember, the goal with this savings account, this emergency cash reserve, is that you want to be able to be accessible. If it's in mutual funds, they fluctuate every day and you could lose money. You want to make sure that if you put in $500, $100, $10, you're going to have $10 plus whatever interest you earn. And see what happens with a lot of people, they get see that money in there, and then they start saying, "Oh wow, I've got $3,000 or $4,000. Let me go buy a new car. Let me buy some more furniture. Let me take a trip around the world, whatever." Well, that money should have been in that account for that vacation and not in your emergency cash reserve, if that makes sense. Okay? So it has to be in your bank account, has to be readily available, converted to cash real easily. You can just use your ATM card, write a check, go to the bank, go to the ATM, withdraw the money, and get the money. And that's real. And friends, I understand that's hard, because if that money starts piling up, and if you've never had that much money in the account, the temptation is to use it for things that you wanted, not things that you need. Remember, need is things like food, shelter, clothing, that kind of stuff. You know, so things outside of that are more wants, what I want. You know, like I want a Corvette. Someday I will get one. I want an RV. Someday I might get one, but it's not a priority. It's just one of my wants. You know, I have a car, a nice car. It's fine. All right. So we've got that. So emergency cash reserve. The other thing we want to look at, number 7 on financial resolutions for 2021, is to look at paying down on your debt. Now, we talked a little about, you know, your credit score and your credit score increasing based on you having a certain amount of, 30, don't use more than 30% of your available credit, paying your bills on time. The thing that you want to look at is having a strategy to pay your debts down. And my suggestion is that you start with the smallest balances first. You say, "Charles, why? Why don't get start the big ones? Those are the big ones that charging you the most interest." And I said, logically, that makes sense, but you have to look at motivation, okay? All right? Because if you've got a big credit card balance, $2,000 or $3,000, $4,000, it's going to take you a minute to pay that down. But if you've got a little credit card balance on one of your cards, $250, well, you might be able to knock that out in 2 or 3 months. So it's a psychological thing. So let me give you an example. So let's say that you have 3 credit cards, one with $1,000 balance, one with $500, and one with $250. And let's say on the $250, you're paying $25 a month. On the one for $500, you're paying, say, $50 a month as a minimum. And then on the $1,000, you're paying $75. So that little $250, you're paying $25, even though that's just $25 a month, you pay that off, okay, in 2 or 3 months, you're motivated, like, "Wow, I did it. Yes, I did it. I did it, did it, did it." Anyway, so you did it. You paid off that $250 balance. Now guess what? Now you could use that $25 that you were paying on that one and add it to the $500. Now you could pay $75 on that one, and you could start paying that one off, and then so forth and so on. Does that make sense? It's all about motivation, psyching yourself out and say, "Listen, if I get that balance paid off, then I can use that money I was paying on that one to pay on the other one, on the next one." So it's all about, but if you start with the $1,000 balance and you're paying $75 a month, you're like, "Wow, it might take me a year or more to pay that off. But if I pay off the little one, then I'll be motivated to start, you know, to pay off the next one and the next one." Now, while you're doing this, you can't add money to it. I mean, in other words, you don't want to be adding stuff to it. So you want to have to, you know, stop using those credit cards. And I heard people do all kinds of things. They hide their credit cards from them. They put them in the refrigerator. They put them under their clothes in their dresser drawers, or whatever the case may be. You know, you have to figure out what works for you. They leave them at home. They don't carry them with them, or whatever the case. You know, so you won't be tempted. But part of being successful financially is having discipline. The discipline to walk into a store and not be tempted by anything that's in there. You know, just to walk past the clothes. For me, you know what my Achilles heel is? Look behind me. I have over 2,000 books. And that's my Achilles heel. If I thank God that bookstores are becoming less common. I mean, I've got to travel a good 20 or 30 minutes to go to a bookstore. Okay. And, but my wife will tell you that I've never met a book I didn't like. That's not accurate, but it, to some extent it's true. You know, but I always keep it in proportion. Okay. And I'm using, but anyway, so you got to find out, my point in sharing that is that you got to find out what your weakness is. Is it clothes, shoes, you know, what, jewelry, you know, whatever, you know, you've got to find out the things that you spend money on that, you know, is your Achilles heel that you just see it, you know, is it food? You know, you like to go out to restaurants and things like that. I mean, what is it that, you know, has your number? And books have my number. That's the one thing. But, you know, I have a lot, I have actually two libraries in my house, believe me. And I don't have all my books up yet. I've got to buy some more bookcases. Anyway, I digress. Okay. So pay down that debt. Okay. Start with the smallest balances first and then work your way up. All right. Almost getting through here. We're got three more things to cover here. Think meaningfully about your insurance. And one of the things, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of TV, but when I do watch, I see all these commercials for car, you know, Geico, Progressive, Allstate, Liberty, State Farm. And there's a reason for that, because people are changing their, they see they can save some money, they'll go out there and do it. Now, in this day and age, you go on the web and compare policies and stuff like that. What I suggest that you do, that every year you should evaluate your insurance, your homeowner's insurance, your car insurance. Can't do that so much with your life insurance, but definitely car insurance and homeowner's insurance. You should look at that and say, okay, can I get a better deal? Okay. There's a lot of value in bundling your homeowners and your auto insurance. You get anywhere from about a 25% discount from doing that. And you say, well, why do insurance companies like to, for you to bundle your stuff? Well, one, they're getting more money out of you. And then there's some overlapping between car and homeowner insurance in terms of liabilities from car insurance and homeowner's insurance. So they like to have, you know, all your insurance coverages. And then, of course, they love having your life insurance and things like that. Can't have your health insurance, obviously, because that's usually do your job. But so I would encourage you to price it out. There's all kinds of mechanisms you can do that. I know most of the insurance companies allow you to go on, especially companies like Geico and Progressive, where, you know, those are sold primarily online and over the phone, that you might want to just see if you can get a better deal. And just price it out. You just never know, because insurance companies change their rates all the time, and you never know when you'll get a better deal somewhere else. And also put your insurance agent on notice that, listen, you know, every year I'm going to be looking back and say, have I got all my discounts, you know, what service, you know, are you providing for me, and those kinds of things. So now let's talk about, you know, life insurance. When it comes to life insurance, my philosophy is real simple. Determine how much you need and buy all you need. Your screen hasn't frozen. I'm just saying, stopping for effect. Determine how much you need and then buy all you need. And you say, what do you mean by that? Well, let's say, you know, if you're a young person, and young to me is anybody under 40. I'm 63, so anybody under 40 is young. You're probably starting a family. And that's when your need for life insurance is so great, because you're starting a family. If something was happening to you or your significant other, what's going to happen to the kids? When I was raising my daughters, I had $1 million of life insurance. And you say, wow, that's a lot. Yeah, but think about it. You know, I was making real good money, six figures then. And think about it. If something happened to you, how are you going to take care of your kids? How are they going to make ends meet, how they're going to finish college. And to even go a step further, I had that $1 million would go to a trust, an irrevocable trust. And not real quickly, how it works is that the $1 million would go into the trust. I had an administrator over the trust, which is my sister. And then they would administer the directions of the trust. And you say, well, why would you have the money in the trust and not go directly to your children? Well, my children were minors, okay, under the age of 16. In the state of Georgia, you have to be at least, you know, I think 16, over 16 is when you become, you know, out of being a minor. But the point is that a minor can't receive money. They say, Charles, why not? Because they're not going to give you $1 million in cash. The money's going to go into a bank account. And so a bank account is a contract, right? Minors can't sign contracts. That's why you see these child actors and entertainers have a guardian, someone who administers their money, who takes possession of their paycheck or whatever, okay? Because they can't sign a contract. And so the money, they're in trust for the money. So the money would go into the trust, and then the trust had directions about how the money was going to be spent. So for example, let's say, I'll make it real simple. Let's say that I passed away when my kids were growing up, and let's say all my kids were 16, were minors. Then the trust had instructions that where they could, you know, get money for their regular expenses, take care of their household expenses, take care of their food, their daily, day-to-day expenses. Then at certain points, they would get, you know, a windfall. So let's say at 18, they would be able to get money for college or to help them with any type of, you know, college education needs or training, you know. And then at, say, 23 or 24, they get another lump sum. They graduated from college, and now they may need to buy a house or get settled in a new job or something of that nature. And on and on and on, you know, until maybe 30 or 35 when the trust, you know, monies have been disseminated. And you say, why would you do that? Well, you would do that because if you gave $1 million to an 18-year-old, guess what they're going to do? Well, you're going to buy a car. They might buy a Learjet. I mean, they're going to buy all kind of crazy stuff, take their friends on vacations. They're going to blow the money. So you give them an opportunity to do right, but also to understand that they are, you know, teenagers and minors, that you want to make sure that they have money for the long haul. So back to my room premise, determine how much you need and buy all you need, especially if you're under 40. And normally that comes down to term insurance and so no more. So let's recap. If you're looking at comparing insurance, you get, if you're under 40, then you get term, okay? If you're over 40, you look at universal life, okay? Cash value, value, or variable universal life. Everybody good with that? Okay, all right. So we're wrapping things up a little bit here. Let's see what we got. My other notes. It's number 8. Okay, number 9. Let me put that aside for a minute. Every so often, you should audit your finances. And I would say at the beginning of the year or the end of the year, whatever one you want to case, is a good time to do that. And what I mean by that, you have a budget, right? But you should have a balance sheet, you know, where you are able to, look at, how much you own, your assets, and then, you know, what your liabilities are. Okay. And so you want to make sure that you have a balance sheet, which most corporations do. So I would say at the end of the year, or beginning of the year, you want to do a balance sheet. And you can get these on the web. If you email me at charlesross@outlook.com, I'll send you one. And this balance sheet lists all the things that you own, all your assets, your house, your car, your cash in your accounts, your business, any of these things. It adds up everything that you own, your 401k, retirement accounts, all the things that you own, then subtracts out the things that you owe, okay, your liabilities. And at the end of it is your net worth. Your net worth is a better indication of what kind of money manager you've been than how much you make. And you say, Charles, what do you mean by that? Oftentimes, you know, you hear of these celebrities and they'll say, so-and-so LeBron is worth $100 million. His net worth is that's, you know, to me, it's kind of misleading because, you know, net worth is really, as I said, your assets minus your liabilities. And think about it. You think folks know what LeBron's liabilities are? So to me, they should be calling it the gross net worth. You know, media is very confusing because they don't know what his life, you don't know what his, what, how much he's bought his house for and that kind of thing. So your net worth is a better indication of what kind of money manager you've been because it tells you what has come in, you know, in your household, what you've been able to hang on to as an asset and not necessarily a liability. That makes sense? And so if you track that from year to year, you'll be able to see how hopefully your net worth is growing. Because the reality is that if you were to sell everything that you own and pay off all your debts, that's what you would have to live on. Let that sink in for a minute. So audit your finances, you know, every year to look at where you are so you can get and make some adjustments to, you know, where you're spending money. And the last thing, and then I'm going to talk about some other things if we have time. We've got about 5 minutes left, is have a money day, you know, a day every, you know, once a week. I alluded to this earlier, but have a money day where you look at your finances, where you look at, you know, where you are, what's going on, what bills coming up. If you're using any of these services like, you know, Quicken or any other budget management services, then you can look at where you are every day. One day a week, pay your bills, you know, you look at your checking accounts, your savings, just, you know, get all, have a file where you keep all that stuff in. All right. So now you only got a few minutes. I just want to do some miscellaneous stuff, some ways that you can cut some money. Okay. Let's talk about the big thing right now that's going on in the media is streaming services. We're under a contract right now with a provider. And when that contract is up, we might get the basic cable. I meant to do this before and I just didn't get to it, is get basic, you know, cable, you know, from any of the cable providers, and then select some of the services that I want for the program. So for example, let me see here. Netflix is one that I want. Amazon Prime Video, Disney, HBO. Now they have HBO, well, not HBO, HBO Max. You know, those are some of the, what we call the on-demand services. In other words, you get something by selecting something to watch, a movie, a TV show, whatever. Now, the live streaming services are the ones like Hulu and YouTube, Sling, you know, things like that. So what you might want to look at is look, and if you haven't done this, if your contract is under contract, because I don't look at, I mean, we have 500-600 channels on cable, on most of these cable stations, and you may look at 10 of them. Okay, you can't look up some of that, all that stuff. So that might be, and now folks are paying over $100, $200 a month for this stuff. And so you might want to selectively say, let me get some basic cable so I can get the channels in my time, in my town, but then also select some streaming services because, you know, Netflix is what, $15 a month, $16, whatever it is. Amazon Prime, I think you pay $100 a year for that, for, you know, services that you get on Amazon.com, HBO Max, all these other ones, Hulu, YouTube Video. And so you could bundle stuff into together and create your own little, basically, cable station, having maybe four or five streaming services, and then, you know, which on demand, and then live streaming services. So I suggest that you take a look at that. And then finally, you know, I have this note here to save money on gas because, you know, people always sit, you know, having to drive around. Now, I hope that people are not driving as much. I know here in Atlanta, when I go into work a couple of days a week, I have to go in for a few hours, that the traffic is so light. I am loving it. And there's a certain part of me says, wow, this pandemic gonna be around the rest of my life. The traffic's gonna be like this. This is great, you know. And so those are the things that I look at, you know, in terms of, you know, that you might wanna take a look at, is that saving money on gas. Gas station rewards programs, warehouse club reward programs like Sam's Club and Costco and so forth. And then there's a website called gasbuddy.com, which does gas providing type stuff. I mean, gas now a comparison of where, you know, the good deals are. So we're just about out of time. We got about a minute left. And I want to thank you guys for tuning in and watching. And I want to also, if you want to reach out to me for any things we talk about, the real estate, that is very, very real. I can share with you some strategies on that. CharlesRoss@Outlook.com. CharlesRoss@Outlook.com. If you want to find ways that you can improve your credit, then hit me up at CharlesRoss@Outlook.com. Just put in a comment, credit, and I'll know what you're talking about. If it's about real estate, just comment, email me real estate, and then I'll be able to provide and get back with you some information. Thank you guys for so much for listening. I think we're just about out of time, and we'll be back in another 2 weeks with another edition of Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. I appreciate you guys listening. Please enjoy the rest of your day.